A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Penguin Random House Audio presents Star Wars Aftermath, Book 1 of the Aftermath Trilogy, by Chuck Wendig, read for you by Mark Thompson. The second Death Star is destroyed. The Emperor and his powerful enforcer, Darth Vader, are rumored to be dead. The Galactic Empire is in chaos. Across the galaxy, some systems celebrate, while in others, Imperial factions tighten their grip. Optimism and fear reign side by side. And while the Rebel Alliance engages the fractured forces of the Empire, a lone Rebel scout uncovers a secret Imperial meeting. Prelude.
Today is a day of celebration. We have triumphed over villainy and oppression, and have given our Alliance and the galaxy beyond it a chance to breathe and cheer for the progress in reclaiming our freedom from an empire that robbed us of it. We have reports from Commander Skywalker that Emperor Palpatine is dead, and his enforcer, Darth Vader, with him. But though we may celebrate, we should not consider this our time to rest. We struck a major blow against the Empire, and now will be the time to seize on the opening we have created. The Empire's weapon may be destroyed, but the Empire itself lives on. Its oppressive hand closes around the throats of good, free-thinking people across the galaxy. From the Coruscant core to the farthest systems in the Outer Rim. We must remember that our fight continues. Our rebellion is over, but the war is just beginning.
Admiral Akbar. Coruscant. Then, Monument Plaza. Chains rattle as they lash the neck of Emperor Palpatine. Ropes follow suit, lassos looping around the statue's middle. The mad cheers of the crowd as they pull and pull and pull! Disappointed groans as the stone fixture refuses to budge. But then, someone whips the chains around the back ends of a couple of heavy-gauge speeders, and then engines warble and hum to life. The speeders gun it, and again the crowd pulls! The sound, like a giant bone breaking! A fracture appears at the base of the statue. More cheering, yelling, and applause as it comes crashing down! The head of the statue snaps off, goes rolling and crashing into a fountain. Dark water splashes. The crowd laughs. And then, the whooping of klaxons. Red lights strobe. Three airspeeders swoop down from the traffic lanes above. Imperial police. Red and black helmets. The glow of their lights reflected back in their helmets. There comes no warning. No demand to stand down. The laser cannons at the fore of each airspeeder open fire. Red bolts sear the air. The crowd is cut apart. Bodies dropped and stitched with fire. But still, those gathered are not cowed. They are no longer a crowd. Now they are a mob. They start picking up hunks of the Palpatine statue and lobbing them up at the airspeeders. One of the speeders swings to the side to avoid an incoming chunk of stone, and it bumps another speeder, interrupting its fire. Coruscanti citizens climb up the stone spire behind both speeders, a spire on which are written the Imperial values of order, control, and the rule of law, and begin jumping onto the police cruisers. One helmeted cop is flung from his vehicle. The other crawls out onto the hood of his speeder, opening fire with a pair of blasters, just as a hunk of stone cracks him in the helmet, knocking him to the ground. The other two airspeeders lift higher and keep firing. screams and fire and smoke. Two of those gathered, a father and son, Rorak and Jack, quick duck behind the collapsed statue. The sounds of the battle unfolding right here in Monument Plaza don't end. In the distance, the sound of more fighting, a plume of flames, flashes of blaster fire. A billboard high up in the sky among the traffic lanes suddenly goes to static. The boy is young, only 12 standard years, not old enough to fight. Not yet. He looks to his father with pleading eyes. Over the din, he yells,
"But the battle station was destroyed, Dad! The battle is over!"
They just watched it only an hour before. The supposed end of the Empire. The start of something better. The confusion in the boy's shining eyes is clear. He doesn't understand what's happening. But Rorak does. He's heard tales of the Clone Wars. Tales spoken by his own father. He knows how war goes. It's not many wars, but just one. Drawn out again and again. Cut up into slices so it seems more manageable. For a long time, he's told his son not the truth, but the idealized hope.
"One day the Empire will fall, and things will be different for when you have children."
And that may still come to pass.
But now, a stronger, sharper truth is required.
"Jack, the battle isn't over. The battle is just starting."
He holds his son close. Then he puts a hunk of statue in the boy's hand. And he picks one up himself.
Part 1. Chapter 1. Now.
Starlines streak across the bright black. A ship drops out of hyperspace. A little starhopper. A one-person ship. Favored by many of the less desirable factions out here in the Outer Rim. The pirates, the bookies, the bounty hunters, and those with bounties on their heads to hunt.
This particular ship has seen action. Plasma scarring across the wings and up its tail fins. A crumpled dent in the front end, as if it was kicked by an Imperial walker.
All the better for the ship to blend in. Ahead, the planet Akiva. A small planet from here, striations of brown and green. Thick white clouds swirling over its surface. The pilot, Wedge Antilles. Once Red Leader, and now, well, now something else. A role without a formal title as yet, because things are so new, so different, so wildly up in the air, sits there and takes a moment. It's nice up here. Quiet. No TIE fighters, no blasts across the bow of his X-Wing. No X-Wing, in fact. And though he loves flying one, it's nice to be out. No Death Star. And here, Wedge shudders. Because he helped take down two of those things. Some days that fills him with pride. Other days, it's something else. Something worse. Like he's drawn back to it. The fight still going on all around him. But that isn't today. Today, it's quiet. Wedge likes the quiet. He pulls up his datapad, scrolls through the list with a tap of the button on the side. He has to hit it a few extra times just to get it to go. If there's one thing he looks forward to when all this is over, it's that maybe they'll start to get new tech. Somehow this datapad had actual sand in it, and that's why the buttons stick. The list of planets clicks past. He's been to, let's see, 5 so far. Florum, Ryloth, Hinari, Abafar, Radonia. This planet, Akiva, is the 6th on the list of many. Too many. It was his idea, this run. Somehow, the remaining factions of the Empire are still fueling their war effort, even months after the destruction of their second battle station. Wedge had the notion that they must have moved out to the Outer Rim. Study your history, and it's easy to see that the seeds of the Empire grew first out here, away from the core systems, away from the prying eyes of the Republic. Wedge told Akbar, Mon Mothma. Could be that's where they are again, hiding out there. Akbar said that it made some sense. After all, didn't Mustafar hold some importance to the Imperial leadership? Rumors said that's where Vader took some of the Jedi long ago, torturing them for information before their execution. And now, Vader's gone. Palpatine, too.
Almost there,
Wedge thinks. Once they find the supply lines that are bolstering the Imperials, he'll feel a whole lot better. He pulls up the comm, tries to open a channel to command, and nothing. Maybe it's broken. It's an old ship. Wedge fidgets at his side, pulls up the personal comm relay that hangs there at his belt. He taps the side of it, tries to get a signal. Once more, nothing. His heart drops into his belly. Feels a moment like he's falling. Because what all of this adds up to is... the signal's blocked. Some of the criminal syndicates still operating out here have technology to do that locally. But in the space above the planet? No. No way. Only one group has that tech. His jaw tightens. The bad feeling in the well of his gut is swiftly justified as ahead, a Star Destroyer punctures space like a knife tip as it drops out of hyperspace. Wedge fires up the engines. I have to get out of here. A second Star Destroyer slides in next to the first. The panels across the Starhopper's dash begin blinking red. They see him. What to do? What did Han always say?
Just fly casual.
The ship is disguised as it is for a reason. It looks like it could belong to any two-bit smuggler out here on the fringe. Akiva's a hotbed of criminal activity. Corrupt satrap governors, various syndicates competing for resources and opportunities. A well-known black market. Once, decades ago, the Trade Federation had a droid manufacturing facility here. Which means if you want some off-the-books droid, you can come here to buy one. The Rebel Alliance procured many of its droids right here, as a matter of fact. New dilemma, though. What now? Fly down to the planet to do aerial recon, as was the original plan? Or plot a course back to Chandrilla? Something's up. Two Star Destroyers appearing out of nowhere? Blocked comms? That's not nothing.
It means I've found what I'm looking for.
Maybe even something much better. That means... time to plot a course out of here. That'll take a few minutes, though. Heading inward from the outer rim isn't as easy as taking a long stride from here to there. It's a dangerous jump. Endless variables await. Nebula clouds, asteroid fields, floating bands of star junk from various skirmishes and battles. Last thing Wedge wants to do is pilot around the edge of a black hole or through the center of a star going supernova. The comm crackles. They're hailing him. A crisp Imperial voice comes across the channel.
This is the Star Destroyer Vigilance. You have entered Imperial space.
To which Wedge thinks, this isn't Imperial space. What's going on here?
Identify yourself.
Fear lances through him, sharp and bright as an electric shock. This isn't his realm. Talking, lying... a scoundrel like Solo could convince a Jawa to buy a bag of sand. Wedge is a pilot, but it's not like they didn't plan for this. Calrissian worked on the story. He clears his throat, hits the button.
This is Gev Hessen, piloting an HH-87 Starhopper, the Rover.
He transmits his data card.
Sending over credentials.
A pause.
Identify the nature of your visit.
Light cargo.
What cargo?
The stock answer is droid components, but that may not fly here. He thinks quickly. Akiva, hot, wet, mostly jungle.
Dehumidifier parts.
Pause. An excruciating one. The nav computer runs through its calculations.
Almost there.
A different voice comes through the tinny speaker. A woman's voice. Got some steel in it. Less crisp. Nothing lilting. This is someone with some authority. Or at least someone who thinks she possesses it. She says,
Gevhesen. Pilot number 45236, Deveronian. Yes?
That checks out. Calrissian knows Hessen. The smuggler, sorry, legitimate pilot and businessman, did work smuggling goods to help Lando build Cloud City, and he is indeed Deveronian.
You got it,
Wedge says. Another pause. The computer is almost done with its calculations. Another 10 seconds at most. Numbers crunching, flickering on the screen.
Funny. Our records indicate that Gevhesen died in Imperial custody. Please let us correct our records.
The hyperspace computer finishes its calculations. He pushes the thruster forward with the heel of his hand, but the ship only shudders. Then the Starhopper trembles again and begins to drift forward toward the pair of Star Destroyers. It means they've engaged the tractor beams. He turns to the weapon controls. If he's going to get out of this, it's now or never.
Admiral Ray Sloan stares down at the console and out the window. The black void. The white stars. Like pinpricks in a blanket. And out there, like a child's toy on the blanket, a little long-range fighter.
Scan them, she says.
Lieutenant Nils Tothwyn looks up, offers her an obsequious smile.
Of course, he says, his jaundiced face tight with that grin.
Tothwyn is an emblem of what's wrong with the Imperial forces now. Many of their best are gone. What's left is, in part, the dregs. The leaves and twigs at the bottom of a cup of spiced tea. Still, he does what he's told, which is something. Sloan wonders when the Empire will truly begin to fracture. Forces doing what they want, when they want it. Chaos and anarchy. The moment that happens, the moment someone of some prominence breaks from the fold to go his own way, they are all truly doomed. Tothwyn scans the Starhopper as the tractor beam brings it slowly but inevitably closer. The screen beneath him glimmers, and a holographic image of the ship rises before him, constructed as if by invisible hands. The image flashes red along the bottom. Nils, panic in his voice, says,
Hessen is charging his weapon systems!
She scowls.
Calm down, Lieutenant. Weapons on a Starhopper aren't enough to...
Wait. She squints. Is that what I think it is?
What?
Tothwyn asks.
I don't...
Her finger drifts to the front end of the holograph, circling the fighter's broad, curved nose.
Here. Ordnance launcher. Proton torpedo.
But the Starhopper wouldn't be equipped with...
Oh.
Oh.
Someone has come prepared for a fight. She reaches down, flips on the comm again.
This is Admiral Ray Sloan. I see you there, little pilot, readying a pair of torpedoes. Let me guess. You think a proton torpedo will disrupt our tractor beam long enough to afford you your escape? That may be accurate, but let me also remind you that we have enough ordnance on the Vigilance to turn you not only to scrap, but rather to a fine particulate matter. Like dust, cast across the dark. The timing doesn't work. You'll fire your torpedo, we'll fire ours. Even if by the time your weapons strike us, our beam is disengaged...
She clucks her tongue.
Well, if you feel you must try, then try.
She tells Nils to target the Starhopper, just in case. But she hopes the pilot is wise, not some fool. Probably some rebel scout, some spy, which is foolish on its own, though less foolish now, with the newly built second Death Star destroyed like its predecessor. All the more reason for her to remain vigilant, as the name of this ship suggests. The meeting on Akiva cannot misfire. It must take place. It must have a result. Everything feels on the edge. The entire Empire standing on the lip of the pit. The ledge crumbling away to scree and stone. The pressure is on.
an almost literal pressure, like a fist pressing against her back, pushing the air out of her lungs. Her chance to excel. Her chance to change Imperial fortune. Forget the old way. Indeed. Wedge winces, heart racing in his chest like an ion pulse. He knows she's right. The timing doesn't favor him. He's a good pilot, maybe one of the best, but he doesn't have the Force on his side. If Wedge launches those two torpedoes, they'll give him everything they have. And then, it won't matter if he breaks free from the tractor beam. He won't have but a second to get away from whatever fusillade they send his way. Something is happening. Here, in the space above Akiva. Or maybe down there, on the planet's surface. If he dies here, nobody will know what it is. Which means he has to play this right. He powers down the torpedoes. He has another idea. Docking Bay 42. Ray Sloan stands in the glass-encased balcony overlooking the gathered battalion of stormtroopers. This lot, like Nils, are imperfect. Those who received top marks at the Academy went on to serve on the Death Star or on Vader's command ship, the Executor. Half of them didn't even complete the Academy. They were pulled out of training early. These will do, though, for now. Ahead is the Starhopper, drifting in through the void of space, cradled by the invisible grip of the tractor beam. Down past the lineup of TIE fighters, half of what they need, a third of what she'd prefer, drifting slowly toward the gathered stormtroopers. They have the numbers. The Starhopper will have one pilot, most likely, perhaps a second or third crew member. It drifts closer and closer. She wonders, who are you? Who's inside that little tin can? Then, a bright flash and a shudder. The Starhopper suddenly glows blue from the nose end forward. It explodes in a rain of fire and scrap.
Whoever it was, Lieutenant Tothwyn says, they did not wish to be discovered. I suppose they favored a quick way out.
Sloane stands amid the smoldering wreckage of the long-range fighter. It stinks of ozone and fire. A pair of gleaming black astromechs whirr, firing extinguishing foam to put out the last of the flames. They have to navigate around the half-dozen or so stormtrooper bodies that lie about still. Helmets cracked, chest plates charred, blaster rifles scattered and broken.
Don't be a naive calf, she says, scowling. No, the pilot didn't want to be discovered, but he's still here. If he didn't want us to blast him out of the sky out there, you really think he'd be eager to die in here?
Could be a suicide attack. Maximize the damage, and...
No, he's here. And he can't be far. Find him.
Nils gives a sharp, nervous nod.
Yes, Admiral. Right away.
Chapter 2.
We have to turn around, Nora says. Plot another course.
Whoa, no,
Huerto says, half laughing. He looks up at her, one half of his dark face burned underneath a mottled carpet of scars. Scars he claims to have earned with a different story each time he tells it. Lava, wampa, blaster fire. Got blitzed on Corellian rum and fell down on a hot camping stove.
Miss Susser!
Now that I'm home, I'm going by my married name again. Wexley.
Nora! You paid me to get you onto the surface of that planet!
He points out the window.
There. Home. Or was once. The planet Akiva. Clouds swirling in lazy spirals over the jungles and mountains. Above it, two Star Destroyers hang there like swords above the surface.
More important, you ain't the only cargo I'm bringing in. I'm finishing this job. They told us to turn around. This is a blockade.
And smugglers like me are very good at getting around those.
We need to get back to the Alliance.
She corrects herself. That's old thinking. The New Republic. They need to know.
A third Star Destroyer suddenly cuts through space, appearing in line with the others.
You got family down there?
She offers a stiff nod.
That's why I'm here. That's why I'm home.
This was always a risk. The Empire's been here on Akiva for years. Not like this, but they're here, and we're gonna have to deal with it.
He leans in and says,
You know why I call this ship the Moth?
I don't.
You ever try to catch a moth? Cup your hands, chase after it, catch it? White moth, brown moth, any moth at all? You can't do it. They always get away. Herky-jerky, up and down, left and right, like a puppet dancing on somebody's strings. That's me. That's this ship.
I still don't like it.
I don't like it either. My life is full of unlikable things. You want to see your family again? Then we're doing this. Now's the time, too. Looks like they're just getting set up. Might could be more on the way.
A half-mad gleam in his one good eye. His other, an implacable red lens, framed in an ill-fitting O-ring bolted to the scarred skin. He grins, then crooked teeth stretched wide. He actually likes this. Smugglers, she thinks. Well, she paid for the ticket. Time to take the ride. The long black table gleams with light shining up from it. A holographic schematic of the Vigilance's docking bay and surrounding environs. It incorporates a fresh droid scan and shows damage to two of the TIE fighters, not to mention the bodies of the stormtroopers. Those left there as a reminder to others what can happen when you tussle with rebels. The pilot of the Starhopper? Most definitely a rebel. Now the question, was this an attack? Did he know they were here? Or is this some confluence of events? Some crass coincidence that led to this intersection? That, a problem for later. The problem now is figuring out just where he went. Because, as she thought, the ship contained no body. Best she could figure, he rigged the proton torpedoes to blow. Before they did, however, he... What? She taps a button, goes back to the Starhopper schematic she pulled off the Imperial databases. There. A stern side door. Small, but enough to load small parcels of cargo in and out. Her new pilot friend ducked out the back. Would have been a considerable jump. Jedi? No, couldn't be. Only one of those out there, and zero chance the rebels would send their golden boy Skywalker. Back to the base schematic. She spins it, highlights the access ducts. That's it. She pulls her comm. Tothwyn, our pilot is in the ducts. I'll bet all my credits you'll find an open vent and...
We have a problem.
The problem is that you interrupted me,
she thinks, but does not say.
What is it?
We have a blockade runner.
Another terrorist?
Could be. Looks like a bog standard smuggler, though. Flying a small Corellian freighter and, let's see, an MK-4.
Dispatch the TIEs. Let them deal with it.
Of course, Admiral.
Everything feels like it's in slow motion. Nora sits, frozen in the navigator's chair, next to Orwerto Neucho, the Scarface smuggler. Flashes of light on his face. Green light from the incoming lasers. Orange light blooming from a TIE fighter meeting its untimely end. Outside, ahead of them, a swarm of TIEs like a cloud of insects. The horrible scream as they pass, vibrating the chair beneath her,
and the console gripped in her white-knuckled hands. In the moments when she blinks, she doesn't see darkness. She sees another battle unfolding.
It's a trap!
Comes Akbar's voice over the comm. The dread feeling as Imperial TIEs descend upon them like red jacket wasps from a rock-struck nest. The dark of space lighting up with a crackling beam of viridian light. That coming from the half-constructed Death Star. Just one more shovel full of dirt on the Alliance's grave as one of their own capital ships is gone. Erased in a pulse of light, lightning, and fire. The freighter dives toward the planet's surface, turning like a screw. The ship shuddering as laser fire scores its side. The shields won't hold forever. Owerto's yelling at her.
You need to handle the guns! Nora! The guns!
But she can't get up out of that chair. Her bloodless hands won't even leave the console. Her mouth is dry. Her underarms wet. Her heart is beating like a pulsar star before it goes dark.
We want you to fly with us,
Captain Antilles says. She objects, of course. She's been working for the Rebels for years now, since before the destruction of the first Death Star. But as a freighter pilot, carrying message droids or smuggling weapons, or just shuttling people from planet to planet and base to base.
And that doesn't change the kind of pilot you are, he says. You outran a Star Destroyer. You forced two TIE interceptors to crash into each other. You've always been a great pilot, and we need you now. For when General Solo gets those shield generators down.
He asks her again, is she in? Will she fly with the red and the gold? Yes. She says yes. Because, of course she does. How could she say otherwise?
Everything gone dizzy. Lights inside the cabin flashing. A rain of sparks from somewhere behind their chairs.
Here in the Moth, everything feels balanced on the head of a pin. Through the glass, the planet. The clouds coming closer. TIE fighters punching holes through them. Vapor swirling behind them.
She stands up, hands shaking.
Inside the bowels of the beast. Pipes and hissing steam. Skeletal beams and bundles of cord and conduit. The guts of the resurrected Death Star.
The shields are down. This is their one chance.
But the TIE fighters are everywhere. Coming up behind them, hawks nipping at their tail feathers. She knows where this goes. It means she's going to die. But that's how things get done.
Gold Leader calms in.
Lando's voice in her ear, and his Sullustan co-pilots just behind it. They tell her what to do, and again she thinks, this is it. This is how I die.
She accelerates her fighter. The heat signature of the core goes left. She pulls her Y-wing right, and a handful of the TIEs break off and follow her deeper, away from the Millennium Falcon, away from the X-Wings. Laser fire frying her engines, popping the top off her astromech, smoke filling the cabin, the smell of ozone. I'm not a gunner, she says. I'm a pilot.
Then she pulls Owerto out of his pilot's chair. He protests, but she gives him a look she's practiced. A look where her face hardens like cooling steel. The look of a raptor before it takes your eyes. The smuggler gives a barely perceptible nod, and it's good that he does. Because as soon as she's down in the chair and grabbing the stick and throttle, she sees a pair of TIE fighters coming up fast from the front.
Her teeth clamp down so hard she thinks her jaw might break.
Lasers like demon fire score the sky ahead, coming right for them.
She pulls back on the stick. The Moth ceases its dive toward the planet's surface. The lasers just miss, passing under the hind end of the freighter, continuing on.
They take out two of the TIE fighters that had been following close behind.
And even as she continues hauling back on the stick, her stomach and her heart trading places, the blood roaring in her ears, she loop-de-loops the ship just in time to see the remaining two TIEs clip each other.
Vertical wing panels smashing together, prying apart, each of the short-range Imperial fighters suddenly spinning away, pirouetting wildly through space like a pair of Republic Day firecracker pinwheels.
We got more incoming,
Awerto hollers from somewhere behind her, and then she hears the gears of the Moth's twin cannons grinding as the turret spins into place and begins barking fire. Clouds whip past. The ship bangs and judders as it kicks a hole in the atmosphere.
This is my home, she thinks.
Or was. She grew up on Akiva. More important, Nora then was like Nora now. She doesn't much care for people. She went off on her own a lot, explored the wilds outside the capital city of Mira, the old temples, the cave systems, the rivers, the canyons. She knows those places. Every switchback, every bend, every nook and cranny. Again, she thinks, this is my home. And with that mantra set to repeat, she stills her shaking hands and banks hard to starboard, corkscrewing the ship as laser fire blasts past. The planet's surface comes up fast. Too fast, but she tells herself that she knows what she's doing. Down there, the rise of lush hills and slick-faced cliffs give way to the canyon of Akar, a winding serpentine valley. And it's there she takes them off, into the rain-forested channel. Drizzles speckling her view, streaking away. The wings of the freighter clip branches, tearing up a flurry of leaves as she jukes left and jerks right, making the Moth one hell of a hard target to hit. Laser fire sears the canopy ahead. Then, a bank of fog. She pushes down on the stick, takes the freighter even lower. Here, the canyon is tighter. Trees stretching out like selfish hands, thrust up from rocky outcroppings. Nora deliberately clips these, again on the left, then on the right. The Moth's turrets belt out cannon fire, and suddenly a TIE comes tumbling end over end like a flung boulder. She has to bank the ship hard to dodge it. It smashes into a tree, a belching fireball. The freighter shudders. More sparks. The cabin goes dark. Awerto,
we've lost the turrets.
Nora thinks,
we don't need them.
Because she knows what's coming. One of the oldest temple complexes. Abandoned, an artifact of architecture from a time long, long ago, when the Ahiako people dwelled here still. But before that, a cascading waterfall. A silver churn of water leaping over a cliff's edge. A cliff they call the Witch's Finger, for the way it looks like a bent and accusing digit. There's a space underneath that bridge of stone. A narrow channel. Too narrow, she thinks. But maybe not. Especially not with the turret gone.
Too late to do differently now.
She turns the freighter to its side. Ahead, the gap under the rock. Waterfall on one side, jagged cliff face on the other. Nora stills her breathing, opens her eyes wide. That mantra comes one last time, spoken aloud.
This is my home.
The freighter passes through the channel. It shakes like an old drunk. What's left of the turret shears off, clangs away, spinning into the waterfall spray. But they're out. Clean. Alive. On the console, two blinking red blips. TIE fighters. Behind them.
Wait for it. Wait for it.
The air claps with a pair of explosions. The two blips flicker and are gone. Awerto hoots and claps his hands.
Ha ha ha! We're clear!
Damn right we are.
She turns the freighter and sets a course for the outskirts of Mira. Nils Tothwyn swallows hard and steps over the shattered glass and puddle of fizzing liquor. That from a ceremonial bottle of Lothalian currant wine. A wine so purple it's almost black. The puddle on the floor at first could be confused for a hole in the floor, in fact. Tothwyn rubs his hands together. He's nervous.
You haven't found him,
Ray Sloane says.
No.
And I saw that the smuggler's ship is gone.
Gone, as in escaped.
She narrows her eyes.
I know what I meant.
Of course, Admiral.
The puddle bubbles. That bottle, given to her to celebrate her rise to the role of Admiral. Appropriate, then, that it was ceremonial. Because that's what became of her role, too. Her leadership was purely ceremony. For years she'd been sidelined. Yes, given command of the Vigilance, but the Vigilance was itself given nothing close to a major role in the struggle against the rising rebellion. Paltry work. Patrols in the Outer Rim, mostly. Defense and escort of bureaucrats, moffs, dignitaries, ambassadors.
It's what she gets.
She made too many enemies early on. Sloane was always one to speak her mind. She didn't know her place, and it hurt her. But now, this is the time for second chances. She cuts the silence. This is a bad time for chaos, Lieutenant. Out there, already two of our esteemed guests have arrived.
Moff Valko Pandion in the Star Destroyer Vanquish, and in the Ascent, one of the Galactic Empire's oldest strategists and tacticians, General Jilia Shale.
Soon the others will arrive. I cannot have this be a time that demonstrates my weakness. We cannot reveal an inability to control our own environment, because if that happens, it will prove particularly to Pandion that we cannot even control this meeting. And this meeting must be controlled.
Absolutely, Admiral. We will find the interloper.
No. I will lead the charge to find our unanticipated guest. You assemble a team. Go to the surface in advance of the meeting. Track the smuggler and freighter that evaded us, just to be sure it's not part of something bigger. This must go right. And if it goes wrong, I will hold you personally accountable.
What little color he has in his face drains.
As you wish, Admiral.
Steam rises like stirred specters off the surface of the moth. The rain has stopped, and now the sun is out, bright and hot. The air thick with humidity. Already Nora feels her hair, normally straight and silver as the waterfall they just passed under only an hour before, starting to curl at the edges. The hair snarling together.
An odd thought. Have I brought a brush?
Did she even bring the right clothes?
What will Temin think of her? She hasn't seen her son in too long now. 3 standard years? At that, she winces.
You are one wild pilot,
Huerto says, coming around the side. He slaps the ship.
I'm man enough to admit that you maybe saved the moth's bacon out there.
She offers a terse smile.
Well, I had a good moment.
Flying like that isn't luck. It's skill. You're a rebel pilot, right?
Right.
Seems you're on the winning team, then.
Not yet,
she thinks. But all she says is...
One hopes.
They really gone. The Emperor. That... Machine Man Vader? Whole Death Star blown to little bitty bits all over again?
It was. I was there. I was inside it, actually.
He whistles low and slow.
Ha! That explains the fancy flying.
Maybe.
Congratulations! You're a hero! Must have been something!
It was something, all right.
Even now, thinking of it, a cold shiver ratchets up her spine, despite the oppressive heat. Others may have felt exhilarated during that battle. But for her, it lives on in her nightmares. Watching good pilots spiral into the surface of that massive base, hearing their screams over the comm.
Your money,
she says abruptly. She pulls a small sack out of her duffel, tosses it to him.
10K on arrival, as promised. Thanks. Sorry about your ship.
I'll get it fixed up. Good luck with your family.
My son, mostly. I'm here to get him and get back out.
He arches an eyebrow over his one good eye.
That's gonna be some tricky business, what with the blockade. You figured a way off planet yet?
No. Are you offering?
Pay me the same and promise to fly the ship again if the chips are down, and you got yourself a deal.
She offers a hand. They shake on it.
Oh,
he adds as he walks away.
Welcome home, Nora Wexley.
Chapter 3.
Akiva has always had Imperials, just not occupying ones. As with many of the worlds on the Outer Rim, wheeling on their axes at the edge of known space, Imperials use the planet, but could never, or perhaps would never, stake an official claim. These exoplanets were beasts, too rough, too wild, too strange to ever be brought under the Galactic Empire's yoke. When the Imperials came here, it was for reasons often personal. The drink, the spice, the smoke, the gambling, the black market goods. Or maybe just to sightsee the wild faces and unmet aliens that cross paths at this outpost of miscreants and deviants. That, all of that, is what brought him here. Sinjir Rath Velis, Imperial Loyalty Officer. Well, ex-Imperial Loyalty Officer. The galactic tide swept him here and washed him up on this planet of wild jungles and jagged mountains. This place of black volcanoes and glass sand beaches. Here he sits. Same seat, at the same bar, in the same back alley quadrant of Mira. With the same Mon Calamari bartender pushing drinks across the oka wood bar top. Nursing a sashen leaf mead. Golden. Sweet. Tastes like a cross between a gibbock fruit and oyoys. Those little red berries his mother used to pick. This is his third of the day, and the sun's only been up a few hours. Already his head is like a fly in a sticky spider's web, struggling and trying to fly free before ultimately failing and giving in to fatal torpor. His head feels gummy, swimmy, boggy. Sinjir holds up the drink and regards it the way one might regard a lover. With passion and fervor, he says to it, "You can count on me. I'm all in." Then he quits nursing it and slams it back. It goes down easy. He shudders with pleasure. Then he taps the bottom of the glass on the wood.
"Bartender! Drink keeper! Peddler of strange liqueurs. Another, please."
The Mon Calamari, named Pock, trundles up. He's old, this Mon Cal. His chin tentacles, or whatever they are, have grown long and thick. A fringed beard of red skin, twitching suckers and glistening barnacles. His one arm is gone, replaced instead with the gleaming silver limb of a protocol droid. A hasty, ill-fitting job, the wires plugged unceremoniously into the blistering flesh of his red shoulder. An unappetizing thing to look at, but Sinjir cares little at this point. He deserves nothing better than this. Pock gurgles and grunts at him in whatever tongue the Mon Cals speak. They have the same conversation every time. Pock makes his sounds. Sinjir asks, then demands that the bartender speak basic. Pock says, in basic,
"I don't speak basic,"
before going back to gabbing in his alien way. And then Sinjir makes his request, and Pock fills the glass. At the end of that exchange, Sinjir makes a new request.
"I'll take... by all the stars and all the skies, it's hot, isn't it? I'll take something refreshing. What's refreshing, my squid-faced friend? Give me that."
The bartender shrugs, his gelatinous frog-egg eyes quivering, before fetching a wooden cup with a couple of ice cubes rattling around in the bottom. Pock grabs a dingy bottle from the shelf, something with a non-basic script scrawled across it, Just as he cannot understand the Mon Cal's words, Sinjir cannot translate the language on the bottle. The Empire had little interest in learning the ways and tongues of other cultures. They didn't even want their people to learn on their own time. Sinjir is reminded of the time he found the young officer studying Ithorese, of all things. That young, fresh-faced fellow, sitting cross-legged on his cot, a long index finger scanning lines of the alien script. Sinjir broke that finger for him. Said it was better than any administrative punishment, and faster, too. Sinjir is also reminded, I am a terrible person. Guilt and shame duel in his gut, like a pair of hissing loath cats. Pock pours from the bottle. Sinjir gives it a swirl. The smell coming off it could strip the black from a TIE pilot's helmet. He tastes it, expecting it to set his tongue and throat on fire, but it's quite the opposite. Not sweet, floral, a taste that fails to match the smell. Fascinating. He sighs.
Hey!
Someone next to him whispers. Sinjir ignores it, takes a long, noisy sip of his strange brew.
Hey!
They're speaking to him, aren't they?
Ugh.
He tilts his head and arches both eyebrows expectantly, only to see some Twi'lek sitting there, skin pink like a newborn baby's. One of the tailhead's head tails comes off the top of his too-tall forehead and winds around his shoulder and underarm, the way a worker might carry a coil of rope or hose.
Buddy!
The Twi'lek says.
Hey!
No, Sinjir says quite crisply. That's not... No. I don't talk to people. I'm not here to talk. I'm here for this. He holds up the wooden cup, gives it a little swirl so that the ice makes noise. Not for this. He gesticulates, waggling fingers in the general area of the Twi'lek.
You seen the Holovid?
The Twi'lek asks, indicating that he's one of those brash, belligerent types who only understand social cues when they're delivered at the end of a fist or at the tip of a blaster rifle. Still, Holovid? He's curious. No. What is it? The Twi'lek looks left, looks right, then pulls out a little disc, bigger than his palm, smaller than a proper dinner plate. Metal ring. Blue glass center. The alien licks his sharp little teeth, then hits a button. An image appears hovering over the disc. A woman. Regal bearing. Chin lifted high, and even in the fuzzy hologram, he can tell her eyes are bright, flickering with keen intelligence. Of course, maybe it's because he already knows who she is. Princess Leia Organa. Once of Alderaan. Now, one of the heroes and leaders of the Rebel Alliance. The recorded image of the princess speaks.
This is Leia Organa, last princess of Alderaan, former member of the Galactic Senate, and a leader in the Alliance to restore the Republic. I have a message for the galaxy. The grip of the Galactic Empire on our galaxy and its citizens is relinquished. The Death Star outside the forest moon of Endor is gone. And with it, the Imperial leadership.
Here the hologram changes to a sight all too familiar to Sinjir. The Death Star exploding in the sky above Endor. He knows because he was there. He saw the great flash, the pulse of fire, the bulging clouds like brains knocked out of some fool's cracked head. All the bits of it up there still, floating like so much detritus. The image flickers. Then it's back to Leia.
The tyrant Palpatine is dead, but the fight isn't over. The war goes on even as the Empire's power diminishes. But we are here for you. Know that wherever you are, no matter how far out into the Outer Rim you dwell, the New Republic is coming to help. Already we've captured dozens of Imperial capital ships and destroyers.
Now the image becomes three-dimensional footage of Imperials being led off a ship's ramp in cuffs.
And in the months since the destruction of the Empire's dread battle station, we have already liberated countless planets in the name of the Alliance.
A new image, rebels being greeted as saviors and liberators by a cheering crowd of... Where is that? Naboo? Could be Naboo. Back to Leia.
Be patient. Be strong. Fight back where you can. The Imperial War Machine falls apart one gear, one gun, one stormtrooper at a time. The New Republic is coming, and we want your help to finish the fight.
One last flickering image. Alliance fighters with fireworks exploding in their wake. Another sight familiar to him. He watched the victorious rebels shooting off their fireworks far above the tops of the evasive Endorian trees. Those strange rat-bear creatures cheering and hooting and chirping in the distance as Singier hunkered down, cold and alone and cowardly in the brush.
It's a new day,
the Twi'lek says, smiling big and broad, with those tiny, pointy teeth lined up in crooked, serrated rows.
One conqueror replaces another, Singier says, lip tugged up in a characteristic sneer.
But the look on his face fails to match the feeling in his heart, much the way the drink in front of him has a smell that doesn't jibe with its taste. In his heart, he feels a swell of hope? Really? Hope and happiness and new promise? Oh, how disgusting. He licks his lips and says,
Still, let's see it again, shall we?
The Twi'lek gives a giddy nod and goes to tap the button. A scuff of boots behind them. Pock the bartender grunts in alarm. A creaky black glove falls on Singier's shoulder. Another lands on the Twi'lek's shoulder, giving it a painful squeeze. Singier smells the oiled leather, the crisp linen, the official issued detergent. The smell of imperial cleanliness.
What have we here? Comes a brutish growl of a voice.
A guttural-tongued officer that Singier turns to find looks rather sloppy. Got a gut pushing out the belly of his gray uniform so far out that one of the buttons has gone undone. His face is unshorn, hair a bit of a muss. The other one next to him is considerably better kept. Firm jaw, clear eyes, uniform pressed and washed. Smug grin. A smugness that isn't practiced, but, as Singier knows well, comes naturally. Behind them a pair of stormtroopers. Now that's something. Stormtroopers. Here on Akiva? Akiva has always had its Imperials, yes, but never stormtroopers. Those white armored soldiers are for war and occupation. They don't come here to drink and dance and disappear. Something has changed. Singier doesn't know yet what, but curiosity scratches at the back of his head like a mole looking for grubs.
Me and my tail-headed friend here are just watching a little propaganda, Singier says. Nothing to cause anyone any alarm at all.
The Twi'lek sticks out his chin. Fear shines in his eyes, but something else too. Something Singier has seen in those he has tormented and tortured. Those who think they won't break. Courage. Courage. What a foolish thing.
Your time is done,
the Twi'lek growls in a shaky voice.
The Empire is over. The New Republic is coming, and...
The oafish officer gives a hard, straight punch to the Twi'lek's throat. The tailhead gurgles, clutching at his windpipe. The other one, the smug one, puts a steadying hand on Singier's shoulder. A warning, unspoken, but clear just the same. Move, and you join your friend. Someone barks. Behind the bar, Pock grumbles and makes some mushy-mouthed warning of his own while pointing to a sign above his head. That sign in Basic reads, No Imperials. It's actually that sign that has kept Singier here day and night for the last week. First, because it means no one from the Empire will come here, which means no one will recognize him. Second, he just likes the irony of it. The oaf grins at the Mon Calamari bartender.
Times are changing, Squidbeard. You might want to reconsider that sign.
He gives a sharp nod to the stormtroopers, and the pair of them step forward, blasters raised and pointed right at Pock.
We're here to stay.
With that, the big oaf starts wailing away on the tailhead again. The Twi'lek man bleats in pain. This is not how it's all supposed to go. Not at all. Sinjir makes a decision then, and it's a decision to simply stand up and walk out, putting all of this behind him. No need to make trouble. No need to become a blip on anybody's radar screen. Walk off. Find another watering hole. That's what he decides to do. It is, quite puzzlingly, not what he actually does. What he does instead is stand up hard and fast. And when Officer Smugface tries to push him back to his chair, Sinjir reaches back, grabs the man's hand, and pries two fingers up with a sharp motion. He goes the distance, ratcheting them back so far that they snap. The man screams. As he should, Sinjir knows how to deliver pain. This causes some concern among the officer's cohorts, of course. The oaf flings the tailhead to the ground and goes for his pistol. The two stormtroopers pivot on their heels, swinging their rifles around to him. Sinjir's drunk. Or drunk-ish. That should be a problem, but to his surprise, it really isn't. It's as if the warm wash of strange liquor has worn away any second thoughts, any pesky critical analysis that might give him pause, and instead he moves swiftly and without hesitation, if a bit inelegantly. He spins behind the wailing, smug-faced officer, lifts his arm like the lever on a Corellian slot machine, and with his other hand, stabs out and plucks the officer's pistol from his holster. Already, the oaf is firing his blaster. His own blaster, well, the smug one's blaster, spins out of his hand, sparking. Oh, damn it. Sinjir tightens his profile and turns the smug one to meet the attack. Lasers sear holes in his chest, and he screams before going limp. Then, with a quick plant of his foot and hard throw, he launches the slack body toward the pair of stormtroopers, neither of whom is ready for the attack. And both of whom fall backward, crashing into tables. The oaf cries out, lifting his pistol again. Sinjir dissects the man's defenses. Hand under wrist, pistol launches up, fires toward the ceiling, dust streaming down on their heads. He stabs out with a boot, catching the man in the shin, knee, upper thigh. The Imperial's thick body crumples like a table with its leg broken. But Sinjir won't let him fall. He holds him up by the wrist, and with his free hand, strikes at vulnerable points. Nose, eye, windpipe, breadbasket. Then back to the nose, where he hooks the oaf's nostrils with a pair of cruel fingers, forcing him to the ground. The man weeps and blubbers and bleeds. The stormtroopers are not down for the count. They scramble to stand, blasters again up. Someone rises up next to the trooper on the right and swings a chair upward in a hard, merciless arc. The chair gets right under the soldier's white helmet and spins it around. That trooper flails just as a bottle of liquor spirals through the air, cracking the second one in the helmet. A bottle flung from the droid arm of the Mon Cal behind the bar. For good measure, Sinjir twists the oaf's wrist so that the pistol drops from the Imperial's grip and into his own. Then he twirls it and fires two shots, one in the center of each of their helmets. The stormtroopers fall. This time, they won't be getting back up. Sinjir plants himself over the oaf. He again grabs the man's nose and gives it a twist. Wonderful thing about the nose is how it's tied to all these sensitive nerve endings behind the face. This fleshy protuberance, yours like a hog snout, if I'm being honest. That's why right now your head is filling with mucus and your eyes are filling with tears.
You rebel scum!
The oaf gargles.
That's funny. Really very funny. You idiot. You think I'm one of them. And really, I'm one of you. I want to know what's going on.
What's going on is that the Empire is here, and you're... Ah!
He twists. The man screams.
Spare me the sales pitch. Details. Why are you here? With stormtroopers, no less.
I don't know! Ah!
Another twist, another scream.
Ah! I swear I don't know! Something's going on, though. It's ramped up fast. We came down off the Vigilance, and then the comms blackout and the blockade.
Sinjir gives a look to Pock.
You know anything about comms being out or a blockade?
The bartender shrugs.
Sinjir sighs,
then jams a fist in the oaf's face. The sloppy officer's head racks back, and consciousness leaves him. Sinjir lets him drop. Then to Pock,
somebody's going to want to clean this up. Ah, good luck with that.
And then, whistling, he traipses out the front of the cantina.
Interlude, Chandrilla. A blurry image. A sound.
Whap! Whap! Whap!
The blurry image shakes. It gets blurrier for a second, and then focuses the other way, lurching inelegantly toward clarity. The image resolves. Standing there are two women. One, a human. Tall, thin, professional. Dark hair coiffed up like a wave about to break. A necklace around her neck that looks like a flock of birds chained together. It catches the light of the sun. Her smile is big, broad, practiced. The other woman is smaller, Pantoran. Blue skin, golden hair, pulled back in a simple, practical braid. She wears a dress to match. Some might call it practical and unpretentious. Others might say it is drab, dull, or even unsophisticated. Her only jewelry is a pair of silver bracelets. Her smile is also practiced, but nervous, too. Behind them, the humble skyline of the capital, Hana City. The first woman, Tracine Kane, says to the Trandoshan behind the camera,
"How's it look, Lug?"
A growl hiss from behind the camera.
"It looks bad. I hid it. Now it looks good."
Tracine gives the other woman, Aaliyah Choco, an apologetic shrug.
"Old tech doesn't always comply. It's your first broadcast,"
Aaliyah says.
"It's understandable. This day is a first for both of us, I think."
Tracine laughs. It's a laugh that sounds almost too big to be real. Maybe it's who she is. Or maybe it, like her smile, is born of effort and orchestration.
"So, here's how this is going to go. I'll begin the interview and I'll do a brief intro, blah, blah, blah. First day of the new Galactic Senate. It's a new dawn for the galaxy, and then right to you, Aaliyah Choco, public relations representative for Mon Mothma and the new Senate. We'll get right into it." "Great,"
Aaliyah says. She takes a deep breath.
"Just great. You look nervous." "I'm a little nervous." "You'll be fine. You're pretty, you're alien, you'll trend well." "Oh,"
Aaliyah says, thrusting up a finger.
"You're going to get a shot of what's behind us, right? Hana City reflects the Senate's humble new beginnings. We're here for the people of the galaxy, or the hard-working people. And Mon Mothma is from here, so..."
Tracine puts a hand on Aaliyah's shoulder.
"We got this." "Oh, but, don't forget, too, to get a shot of the art installation in the city circle. It's a bunch of stormtrooper helmets painted different colors, marked with different symbols like flowers and starbursts and alliance sigils. It's by the artist..."
Tracine gives Aaliyah's arm a squeeze.
"I said we got this. We have the footage. You're the last link in the chain. We talk to you, then the Senate walks in. Nothing will go wrong. You good?"
Aaliyah hesitates. The smile on her face is strained. She looks like a panicked squawk bat frozen in the beam of a miner's headlamp. But she nods.
"Yes, I'm good. I'm fine. I can do this.
To the camera, Tracine points.
We're on in three, Lug. Three, two.
She mouths the word, one.
This is Tracine Kane, broadcasting on the first day of the Queen of the Core Network. I'm standing here with Aaliyah Choco, public relations representative of Chancellor Mon Mothma and the new Galactic Senate here on Chandrilla.
Chapter 4. The interrogator droid hovers. A small panel along its bottom slides open with a whir and a click. An extensor arm unfolds, an arm that ends in a pair of cruel-looking pincers. So precise and so sharp, they look like they could pluck a man's eye clean from his head. A performance this droid has likely performed once upon a time. The arm reaches down toward its target. It grabs the 10-sided die, lifts it, drops it. The die clatters, face up, a 7. The droid exclaims in a loud, digitized monotone,
"Ah, I am afforded the chance to procure a new resource. I will buy a spice lane that connects to my 4 other spice lanes. That gives me 5 total, which grants me 1 victory point. I am now winning. The score is 6-5.
Temin's lips curl into a frustrated frown. The board beneath the two of them consists of a map of countless hexagonal territories. Some of the hexes contain planets, others stars or asteroid belts or nebulae. He has never won a game of galactic expansion against the repurposed interrogator droid, but he's close now. It's never been this close.
Ease off the throttle, you overconfident Borgle Ball. 1 point does not make you a conqueror.
He rolls the die. A 5. Ugh, not enough to earn him a new resource. But he can place a new shipping lane or a smuggler route. He has to think about this. He leans back on the chair, lets his eyes gaze over the workshop and market. All around, shelves and tables, mounded with what looks to be junk. And a lot of it is. Astromech parts, starship scrap, disassembled blasters. Over in the corner is a WED repair droid, long defunct, wound up with blinking, twinkling lights. Hanging above his head from a set of braided cables is a speeder bike scored with laser marks. And there, against the far wall, is an old Trade Federation battle droid, scrunched down into its folded-up form and wrapped up in a ratty blanket. It's not one of the B-2s, the war droids with the cannons on the forearms and the hard chest plating. It's not one of the droidicas, either. Those roly-poly death machines, as if a jungle scorpion had a baby with a rolling thermal detonator. It's just an old B-1. A clanker. Everything here is, or looks like, a clanker. Temin picks up a smuggler route tile, marked with a red dotted line, and he's about to place it when the interrogator droid suddenly turns, as if to face somebody.
"You have customers,"
the droid intones.
Temin cracks his knuckles and stands up, plastering on his best salesman smile.
The young teen kicks his rolling chair away and turns to face a trio of thugs. His smile wavers, but only for a second.
"A Kurivar, an Athorian, and an Ebonito enter a junk shop," he says, cracking wise.
They don't seem amused.
"It's like the start of a joke,"
Temin says, then adds,
"But if you have to explain it, it sort of stops being funny."
He claps his hands.
"What can I do for you, gents?" "I am a lady,"
the Kurivar snaps, stepping forward. She adjusts her crimson cloak and lifts her chin. The spiraling horn atop her head is twisted and bent. A pale tongue flicks the air and licks craggy scaled lips. She has a long serrated knife hanging at her hip. Temin knows who she is. Who all three of them are. The Ebonito with the fleshy nose slits and the skin tendrils around that scowling, puckered mouth. Tumatari, known usually as Tombs. The Athorian, with the sleepy eyes, the threadbare coat,
the cannon slug over his tree branch-looking shoulder, Herf, and the Kurivar, Macario Graven. Though, truth be told, Temin really thought she was a he. The Kurivar don't make it easy to tell. All three work for, or rather belong to, Sarat Nuat. They are the Celestin's property.
Ma'am,
Temin says, spreading his arms wide.
What can I do for you today? What junkyard delights can I offer you?
Hot the rancor spit, you little puke,
the Abenito says. In the alien's tongue, the Ithorian adds,
You have stolen from the goodly savior of Mira, Surat Nurat.
Hey, no, Temin says, holding up his hands. We're all friends here. I would never, ever steal from Surat. We're buddies. It's all good.
You stole from Surat,
the Kurivar hisses.
Worse, you have offended him with grave insult by taking what is rightfully his.
Temin knew this day would come, just not so soon. A nervous feeling rises in his belly.
The last thing I would want to do is insult Surat. We all could only wish we were as savvy and as slick as he is. I don't know what you think I stole from him, but...
Macario the Kurivar takes another assertive step forward.
Think hard about what happened on the Trabzon Road. Does that tickle your brain stem?
Temin snaps his fingers, a nervous habit he picked up from his father.
You mean the transport that crashed out there? No, I mean, yeah, yes. I definitely scavenged what was left there. I own that. That one's on me. But I had no idea that was Surat's ship.
It had its guild sigil all over it.
Tombs the Abenito seethes. The ringlets of skin hanging from his face twitch and tremble as he speaks.
Not that I could see. The transport was attacked by the Ugtin. Such primitives, you know. They burned that thing good on the outside. Roasted it like a flora keep before plucking its feathers.
And yet the insides were ripe for your plunder,
Macario accuses.
They couldn't crack that nut. The Ugtin, I mean. Their crude knives couldn't pop the latch. But I had a torch, and...
He fake laughs.
I beseech you, friends. I didn't know who I was taking from.
He knew. Of course he knew. And he knew one day this would catch up to him. But the potential payout. If ever he hopes to unseat Surat, he has to play the games with big moves. No weak-kneed bowing and scraping. No soft touches. No hesitant plays. Everything big. Bold. Smart as a whip. Strong as a bull.
You still have the weapon?
Tombs asks. Temin clears his throat and then lies through clenched teeth.
Not so much.
The Kurivar's eyes go wide, with rage and indignation, if Temin has to guess. Macario moves fast. The knife is off the alien's belt, and in the span of a flash of lightning, against Temin's throat. Outside, the weather complies, adding its own threat. A rumbling boom of thunder. A hard rain falls against the roof of Temin's shop, only serving to accentuate the silence. Behind Temin, the interrogator droid hovers near the table where the galactic expansion board sits. The boy swallows.
I'll make it up to you. I've got lots on offer here. Hey, look, speeder bike. Or I can scrounge up a couple of droids.
This is all junk,
Macario says.
Surat knows your trick, and so we know your trick. This!
With her free hand, the Kurivar makes a move similar to, and maybe mocking of, Temin's own gesture when they got here.
All of this is a front. You are no junk merchant.
One man's trash is another man's treasure.
The knife presses harder against his exposed throat.
We care nothing for trash. We care everything for treasure.
So let's talk treasure then.
Surat has a price.
He feels something wet drip down his throat. Blood or sweat? He's honestly not sure.
Everybody does. Name the price.
Makariel smiles. A terrible sight to behold. For the Kurovar are, to Temin's mind, uglier than a hapabore walking backward. All those lumps and scales. A nose like a fat, segmented grub. Bone spurs above the eyes. Oof, the breath doesn't help either. It stinks of rotting meat. The Kurovar says with a flick of her tongue,
"Your shop."
The shop? Like the building?
And everything in it, and everything below it.
Now, real panic. A cold saline rush through his blood. They know. They know where he keeps some, most of his best goods. That is not ideal.
I have something,
he blurts.
Something big. Something Surat wants. Okay? Okay, just, can I show you? Please? Please?
The three alien thugs give one another looks. The Ithorian, Herf, gives a noncommittal shrug. In Ithorese,
we might as well see.
Makariel removes the knife from his throat. He gasps,
rubs his neck.
His hand comes away wet with sweat, not with blood. He claps his hands.
It's right over there. See that ratty blanket? It's under there.
Makariel nods to Herf. The Ithorian unslings the cannon. It's a custom mod job, that gun. Based off a DLT body, but jacked up for bigger firepower. The barrel is long. So long, it's probably as tall as Temin. The stoop-necked Ithorian blinks his hammerhead eyes, then uses the barrel of the gun to lift up the blanket, thus exposing the first-generation battle droid, the B-1. It stands up. Its bones rattle as it does. Literal bones. The bones of beasts, fish, birds, bound to its metal limbs with twine and wire. Those aren't the only modifications to the droid's appearance, either. Half its head is missing, replaced with a telescoping red eye. The front of its nose has been sharpened and curved, less the bill of some plucky waterfowl, more the beak of a bird of prey. All of it painted black and red, meant to strike a note of fear. The alien thugs all laugh. The Abanito laughs so hard he stoops over, slapping a knee, little green mushroom ears twitching with delight.
A battle droid?
Makariel asks, more laughter.
You wanted to show us a battle droid? The most incompetent droid soldier in the history of both the Republic and the Empire? A mechanical comedy of errors?
The way the alien enunciates that last bit,
a mechanical comedy of errors. And you believe that Surat Nuat wants a meager, worthless B-1 droid?
I call him Mr. Bones, Temin says.
Upon saying the droid's name, its eye grows a sinister red.
Mr. Bones is online,
the droid says. Its voice is a grinding distortion, interrupted by bursts of static. Words speed up and then slow down again, mangled by what seems a faulty vocoder.
Hello, everyone.
The Abanito shakes his head.
An idiotic name for an idiotic droid.
I think you've insulted him,
Temin says. The laughing stops for just a moment as they try to figure out what that even means, or what game Temin is even playing. Their hesitation is not wise. Mr. Bones cackles, a scratchy, warped laugh from his speakers, as his one hand swings free on a hinge. From the hold,
springs a sparking, vibrating blade. The Athorian is slow to react, and by the time Herf is bringing up his DLT cannon, Bones has whipped his arm back 3 times already, and the cannon is whittled down, 3 smoldering bits clattering to the floor. The Ebonito draws a blaster. Bones tackles Herf and slams him straight into Tombs. The Ebonito flails and falls, with the Athorian landing on top of him, and Bones on top of him. Temin's B1 bodyguard begins pounding both fists down, punching the Ithor's oddly shaped head hard enough that each hit ratchets it back into Tombs' noseless face. Mr. Bones gavels and laughs. Makariel's maw stretches wide, hissing a gassy exhortation of distress and rage. The Korovar reaches behind, under her cloak, and draws a blaster, pointing it right at Temin's head. Temin, who is now frozen, reaching for his own blaster, stuck in a leather holster bolted to the underside of a nearby table.
"Do not pick that up,"
Makariel whispers. Temin calculates his odds. They're not good. He withdraws his hand, smiles, nods.
"Sure, sure. Tell your droid to back off." "Now hold on." "Tell him."
Temin grins.
"Which droid are we talking about here?"
Makariel's pale, ghostly eyes focus, then narrow in bewilderment. Just as the interrogator droid floats up behind her, a syringe fixed to the end of its second extensor arm. Temin chuckles. The floating droid stabs down with a needle. A needle filled with a toxic narcotic. Locally sourced, locally brewed, and with enough stopping power to put a Gamorrean to sleep for the better part of a week. The needle snaps off and clicks as it hits the ground, never actually delivering its toxic payload.
"Right, right,"
Temin thinks, with no small disappointment.
"The Korovar have really hard skin, don't they?"
Temin runs. He leaps up over a table, then to another table, then across a trio of metal stools. Blaster fire sizzles in the air behind him, knocking junk off shelves. An oil can hops off the corner of a table ahead of him. Temin yells as he bolts for the door. There, ahead, the door is open. Someone is standing there. Someone new. Long, dark cloak. Someone with a blaster all his own. The new figure raises the blaster. Temin drops his weight, letting his legs skid out from under him. Laser fire trades above his head, and somewhere behind him, Makariel yelps in pain. There comes a crash. Temin leaps to his feet, presses himself flat against the textured wall of his junk shop. Makariel's down, writhing and howling. Mr. Bones has lifted his head like a curious, startled hound. The new visitor regards the situation, then peels back his hood. It's not a him at all. It's a her. Temin's eyes go wide.
"Mom?"
Chapter 5.
"Admiral Sloan, the shuttle is ready."
She stands, hands behind her back, staring down a long hallway. At the end of the hallway, a vent cut free with a microtorch. Ahead of her, stormtroopers go in and out of doors, cabins, sleeping quarters. No sign of the interloper anywhere. She bites down on her teeth to suppress anger. Lieutenant Tothwyn says again,
"Admiral, I said..."
"I heard what you said," she snaps.
"The others, they are already heading to the planet's surface."
"Everyone is accounted for, then?"
"Yes. Pandion, Shale, Arsene Crassus's yacht showed up on screen a short while ago and is now descending to Akiva."
"And Yup Tashu?"
"Advisor Tashu's shuttle is on screen as well. We directed him to continue on toward the meeting site. They're expecting you to be there ahead of them."
"They can wait."
"Of course. It's just that Moff Pandion is already..."
"Tell me," she says, "this deck, nothing of import here, is there?"
"Admiral?"
he asks, not understanding her. She wheels on him, impatient. "I mean, this is just empty guest rooms here."
And at the other end, kitchen, sanitation, the game room.
Sloane chews on that. Could he be using the sanitation chute? The stormtroopers have already checked it out and didn't find anything.
Perhaps he thought to steal a bit of food.
No, she says, suddenly figuring it out.
It's a ruse. It's always a ruse with the rebels, isn't it? Always some trick, some game. He didn't stop here. He just wants us to think he did, so we waste time.
That ventilation shaft! Where does it go? Show me the schematic!
Tothwyn fumbles with the holodisc, snaps it on. There, the schematic for the vigilance. She scrolls through it, moving the image about, highlighting the shaft and following it to its logical conclusion.
Oh no. She growls. I know where he's going!
Or where he's already gone.
Damn it!
His leg isn't broken, he doesn't think, but it's jammed up pretty good. Once upon a time, he crashed an A-wing at the lip of a volcano. One of his first runs out as a pilot for the then burgeoning Rebel Alliance, at the urging of a friend, a Rebel agent known only as Fulcrum. That crash left them limping for months, and there, his leg was broken. In three places, no less. Almost cut short any career he hoped to have as a pilot. But he convinced the rebels to let him work a freighter manning the guns and as an occasional navigator, so. Whatever the case, he's pretty sure the leg isn't busted. But it sure hurts from his jump out of the back of that starhopper, moments before he set the torpedoes to blow. Clambering through the ventilation ducts didn't help the pain, but getting away from Imperial eyes was key. Since then, he's been sneaking around, doubling back, covering his tracks, dropping in and out of vents. At first, he was guideless, without a plan. But it didn't take long to realize what he had to do. And better yet, being here on this Star Destroyer offered him something of a real opportunity. Communications are blocked to all traffic in the space above Akiva, and he's betting to all on the ground, too. But if anybody has the channel still open, it's the Empire. And so now, he stands in the communications room. The bodies of three comm officers lie nearby. One slumped over her station. Another two dropped on the floor. Stunned, not dead. Wedge isn't a killer. He's a pilot. And taking down other pilots means ending the lives of combatants. Comm officers aren't soldiers, aren't pilots. They're just people. Wedge thinks, that's a lesson we could stand to learn. Imperials are just like us. Some of them, at least. It's easy to label those who serve the Galactic Empire as pure evil, all enemy. But truth is, a lot of those who do so were either sold a bill of lies or forced to by threat of pain or death. Already the New Republic has seen defectors. Men and women who have seen a chance for escape, for a new life. That means getting the message out. That means running the comms now and bringing in the troops. Two holoscreens rise up. On the one side, he tries to aim a subspace frequency toward New Republic space. But all those frequencies remain blocked. That presents a short-term problem and a long-term one. Right now, it means he can't send a message to where it needs to go. In the long term, it means the Empire knows their frequencies, suggesting that somewhere there's a mole in the halls of the New Republic. Maybe unsurprising, but all the more reason he has to get a message out somehow. He flips over to local channel traffic. There, none of the known Republic channels is blocked. That means he can get a message out to those loyal, but they must be local. What are the chances that here, at the precipice of colonized space, he'll find someone listening, someone loyal to the New Republic? It's the only shot he has. He dials it up. Wedge zeroes in on the emergency channel, then draws the mic out of the console, the metal cold in his hand. Into it, he starts to speak.
This is Captain Wedge Antilles of the New Republic. Repeat, this is Wedge Antilles of the New Republic. I am trapped on the Star Destroyer Vigilance in the space above Akiva, and I am in... A bright light. The bark of a blaster.
He cries out in pain as a laser bolt burns a hole through his shoulder. His hand reflexively opens. The microphone clatters away. He paws at his hip for his own blaster, but another shot! And the weapon that hung there is quickly spun to slag and knocked off his belt. Wedge, breathing deep, gritting his teeth against the pain, wheels on his attacker. He expects to meet some stormtrooper, or ironically a comm officer who is just returning from a meal. But no. The woman standing there is in a crisp admiral's uniform. She's dark-skinned, with cold brown eyes to match. In her hand, a long-barreled pistol. A unique blaster of elegant mirrored chrome.
"Please!"
he says, clutching his shoulder, favoring his leg. She takes three steps into the room. "I cannot have you complicating what's about to happen. The future of the Empire, of the whole galaxy, is at stake." And then, a flash of surprising empathy. "I'm sorry."
"Wait, let's talk this out."
He swallows hard, wincing.
"It's over. You know it's over. We can negotiate a surrender, a meaningful surrender. Right here, right now. You and I can..."
Behind her, a small squadron of stormtroopers catch up, their armored boots clattering in the hall behind her. They raise their blasters as she lowers hers.
"I'm sorry, Captain," she says.
Then to her backup,
"Arrest him. Take him to detention level..." "No. Wait."
She snaps her fingers.
"Have him shackled and taken to my shuttle.
Have a medical droid in attendance." With a stiff smile, she says, as if for his approval,
"We are not animals."
Chapter 6. For years, Nora did not weep. Could not weep. She joined the Rebel Alliance as a pilot, and when the decision was made, a decision made less in her head and more in her gut, she cinched everything up, put extra steel in her spine. All the fears and worries and emotions became extraneous things. Anchors, she thought, mooring her to an old life, to an old way of thinking. If she was going to make it through this, then she had to cut those fetters with a cold, merciless knife, leave them behind her. The Alliance deserved that much from her. This fight afforded them no time for weeping. They did not possess the luxury of looking back. Since she joined the fight, she has had two moments when she wept. The first was only months earlier, after the battle over Endor had concluded. After she and her Y-Wing and her laser-crisped astromech emerged from the labyrinth of half-constructed passages inside the second Death Star, just escaping in a plume of flame as the whole thing began to implode and then explode behind her, the shockwaves causing her little fighter to tumble end over end until she almost passed out. That night, she sat alone in a changing room on the Star Cruiser Home One, and sitting there half in and half out of her jumpsuit, she wept. Like a baby without its mother. Hard, racking sobs hit her like crashing waves until she was curled up on the floor, feeling gutted. A day later, she got her medal. She smiled, turned toward the applause of the crowd. She didn't show them how stripped down and scraped clean she really felt. The second time is right here, right now, holding her son and feeling his arms around her in turn. The tears that spill now are not the throttling sobs of that night months ago, but tears of happiness. And though she is hesitant to admit it, even in her own mind, of shame. It feels like a completed circuit. What she lost that night in the battle is returned right here, right now. Then she felt gutted. Now she feels filled up once more. And then everything snaps forward. Time unfixes its feet from this slow, perfect moment. She has not seen her son in years, after all. And suddenly, Temin reveals himself less a child and more a man. He's young, but starting to grow into himself. Lean,
ropey, a mass of dark hair sprouting up off the top of his head. He's snapping to the strange battle droid on the floor, clapping his hands.
Bones! Pull the spear around back! We need to load these slime-guzzling hut mothers up, and you need to fly them out far as you can along the Trabzon Road. I'm talking all the way to the Korobides!
Here he turns to her and says,
These eddies of water where the river meets the road. Rapids.
Then back to the droid.
You hear me, Bones?
The B-1 battle droid stands up, all the bones dangling from its body rattling as it does. The mechanical man gives an awkward salute, and in a garbled, distorted voice says,
Roger, roger. Bodies be gone, master.
Then the robot hums a discordant tune as it begins to drag the thugs out toward a back portal door. Temin calls after.
Cover them up before you go! Use that blanket!
From outside, the mechanized voice.
Roger, roger, master!
Nora says,
Temin, I don't know what's happening.
Mom, not now!
He snaps.
Here, come on!
He hurries across the room, hopping over a pile of spilled junk. He reaches up for the dented skull of an old translator droid, and with his fingers forked, presses in on the eyes. They depress with loud clicks. And a few meters away, a shelf slides away, and after it, a section of wall. Revealed behind the opening is a set of steps. Temin waves her on.
Come on! Come on!
Then he ducks down the passage. This is all a bit dizzying, but what choice does she have? Nora skirts the edge of the junk shop and follows her son down the staircase. Her boots clank on the metal steps. It gets darker and darker until she can't see anything. And then... lights. Garish, bright, coming on one bulb at a time. A room like the one upstairs. Except the shelves are clean, shining. And home not to junk, not to trash, but to bona fide treasures. Treasures ranging from top-shelf technology to strange artifacts.
Welcome to the real Temin's Mercantile, he says.
She sees parts for droids that haven't existed since she was a little girl. A rack of high-end blaster rifles, a crate of thermal detonators, a shelf of old books and mysterious patina-darkened vases depicting images of men in dark robes with red faces.
I don't understand, she says.
Upstairs, I sell junk. Down here? Different story.
No,
she says.
I mean, we used to live here. This was our home. What happened?
He stops and stares at her, regarding her almost like she's a stranger.
What happened is, you left.
The sudden silence between them rises like an invisible wall. And then, as soon as it arrives, it breaks again, and Temin is once more wheeling around the room, chattering as he does.
So, Sarat knows all of this is down here. That's not good. And he knows I stole this, too.
Here, Temin points to a matte black crate bound up with carbon-banded locks.
I stole it from Sarat. Some kind of weapon, I guess. No idea what it does. He knows it's down here, but what he doesn't know, what he can't know is...
Her son hurries over to the opposite corner and whips a blue tarp off something. An old Valacord. Their old Valacord. The instrument wasn't an artifact from ancient history, but rather from Temin's own. And here the memory hits her like a gale force wind. Temin and his father, Brenton, sitting at that very Valacord, playing one of the old jaunty minor songs together and laughing. Temin says,
Watch, or rather, listen.
He taps out five notes on the keys. The first five notes of one of those old minor songs. The shanty of cart and cobble. And with that, another door opens up. This one with a pop and a hiss. Even as it opens, a faint breeze keens through the old stone walls beyond. She smells mold, decay. Something metallic.
No way Sarat knows about this, he says.
It hits her then. The glint in his eyes. the smirk on his face. At first she thought he reminded her of his father. But maybe, just maybe, he reminds her of her.
Temin.
So, if we go into the old passages underneath the city and...
Temin!
She uses her motherly voice, the one she uses to get people's attention. Nora softens it.
Son, can we take a moment?
Time matters. Those thugs who are here, eventually they're going to wake up